Then, we have three English-speaking countries that boast home prices of around 5 times income: Singapore, Canada, and Ireland. Ireland took a hit in the 2008 crisis, but Singapore and Canada didn't. Singapore has taken a hit since 2016, but only because it put a 16% surcharge on foreign buyers. If they flip their real estate within 1 year of buying it, they're smacked with another 12%. If they flip after 2 years, they must swallow another 16% tax. Malaysia and the UK come in at closer to 4.5 times income, but of course that doesn't include London, which is high on the list of global city bubbles. The good old US of A comes in at the most affordable. On average, it costs us just 3.9 times our income to buy a home. Of course, this doesn't apply in the bubbliest cities, which really are the fly in this real estate bubble soup. The most expensive cities in China and English-speaking countries. When you look at average home prices to average income, the valuations are much more extreme as the higher end dominates, especially in a bubble. Beijing tops the charts in this category. It boasts home prices 33.8 times income. Only Hong Kong is higher at 36 times. It's no wonder the Chinese living there either must own a small box with room for nothing more than a bed, or they must commute. Shanghai comes next, with real estate prices at 32.6 times income, on average. As with Hong Kong and London, the average is much higher than the everyday valuations, thanks to super affluent speculation and foreign buying. In China's case, it's a result of the rich speculating. Real estate in Shenzhen, the more industrial city outside Hong Kong, is priced even higher. Sydney comes next, as I would expect, at 12.2 times. Vancouver is close behind at 11.8. Auckland real estate costs 10 times income. Melbourne real estate sits at 9.5. Honolulu at 9.4. And Los Angeles and San Francisco are both at 9.3. San Francisco is another city that attracts the uber-rich and foreign buyers, with an average valuation at 12.1, similar to Sydney. London has the highest average price to income, at a whopping 27.8. Yet its median comes in at 8.5, lower than San Francisco. Toronto and Miami round out the other expensive cities at 7.7 and 6.1 respectively. New York's average valuation is a more reasonable 5.7, while its average is 13.0, higher than San Francisco or Sydney, but much lower than London. Singapore is another city that has a low median ratio of 4.8, but a sky-high average of 21.6. That's why Singapore had to slap on such an aggressive foreign buyer tax in 2015. So that's where to look for the bursts in the next real estate crash. It'll come from those cities where foreign buyers and wealthy speculators have driven prices to the extremes, specifically Hong Kong, London, Singapore, Manhattan, as opposed to broader New York, Vancouver, San Francisco, and Sydney. On the flip side, the most affordable large cities in the United States are Atlanta, with valuations at 3.1 times income, Dallas at 3.7, Chicago at 3.8, and Tampa and Phoenix, both at 4.1. These are cities where everyday people can still barely afford houses. Declines in those areas should be less severe, but still substantial. Let's apply the bubble model I discussed in the previous chapter to this real estate beast. Applying the bubble model. Three key cities as examples. As explained in Chapter 11, with stocks, bubbles tend to burst in half the time it took them to build exponentially. Real estate is different. Property price bubbles take about the same time to burst as they did to build. That's because real estate is harder to sell, and many owners live or work in it, so they're emotionally attached. They won't dump it as fast as they will a stock. Stock bubbles also tend to crash back to where the bubble started, while real estate holds up a little better, retracing only 85% of the bubble. Let's look at the San Francisco bubble to illustrate. The city by the bay is not only one of the bubbliest cities in the United States, but also an example of a double bubble, where current prices are now significantly higher than in the first one, which makes it more overvalued than ever. But what's less clear is whether it will correct toward its original bubble origin or back toward the lows of the last bubble burst. Either way, it'll be painful. When charting out a bubble, I always start with calculating the rough bubble origin. That's where prices start to accelerate beyond the natural trends. For San Francisco, I place this around mid-1997. The first bubble accelerated into a peak in early 2006. It was longer than most in the United States, lasting 8.75 years. To get the bubble intensity, I divide the times gain, in this case 3.0 times, by the duration, 8.75 years. That gives me a medium bubble intensity of 0.35. In this case, the bubble model would have forecast a decline of 58%, but we saw prices drop only 45%, and in a shorter amount of time than normal, just 3 years into early 2009. Why did it happen that way? Because this was a very buoyant area with strong job growth and foreign buying. That stopped the first bubble from deflating properly, and set the second bubble in motion in early 2012. That has lasted 5 years thus far and looks close to peaking. But double bubbles aren't common, and that makes them less predictable. Using my bubble model, my best-case scenario is that San Francisco crashes back down to that early 2009 low, which means property prices will lose 49% from the time we penned this book. If they rise further, real estate owners face greater than 50% losses. The worst-case scenario is that prices fall back to the initial bubble origin from back in 1997. That would be a 68% to 72% punch in the gut, although I think this is unlikely. Another good illustration of my bubble model at work is in real estate in Australia. Sydney has a classic five-wave advance that looks close to peaking. Every time I speak there, the local economists and journalists attack me viciously when I tell them they're on the verge of a crushing real estate collapse. But when I last spoke there, in late May of 2017, more experts admitted that the country definitely has a bubble. Now it's a question of when it will burst and how much it'll hurt. Sydney's real estate bubble began to inflate exponentially in 2001. It's taken 16 years to advance 3.1 times. That's not as high an intensity as other bubble cities like London, but like San Francisco, Sydney was already expensive. And this bubble has built over a longer time frame, as have those in Melbourne and Brisbane, and other major cities. Perth has already seen declines of as much as 50% on the high end, with the iron ore and commodity bubbles collapsing and Australia's declining trade with China depressing total exports. My model suggests that Sydney real estate will experience a long slide into 2032 to 33. That's 16 years of decline if it peaks later in 2017. However, I have a hard time believing that, because Australia's demographics are the most favorable in the developed world. When I apply my Dyers versus Buyers model to Australia, it peaks around now and falls into 2022, then rises back near these levels into 2026, before declining again into around 2043. Note that Australia's net demand never turns negative, as has happened for years in Japan, and will occur from 2028 to 2039 in the United States. It just drops from a double peak of around 1.25 million a year down to 700,000, or 44%. Sydney property prices will more likely crash by about 53% into the early 2020s, going back to early 2006 lows, or 58% if I strictly apply the 85% bubble retracement rule. Then it will bounce back for several years, but it's unlikely to ever get back to its current highs. From the late 2020s forward, it could decline once more and for years after that. Australia, and Sydney in particular, has another unique attribute, a high concentration of Chinese buying. When the Chinese bubble bursts, it'll wallop Australia's export economy as well as its real estate market. But those Chinese buyers may well continue to launder money via places like Australia when their bubble first bursts, until the Chinese government is forced to clamp down on such practices. And they'll have to at some point. Vancouver and Toronto are the bubbliest cities in Canada, a country that never had a serious correction like the United States. Vancouver's chart is very much like Sydney's, and it's due to crash by 55-60%. And it, too, has slapped on a hefty foreign surcharge to start putting the brakes on foreign and Chinese buying. That brings us to the mother of all bubbles. Shanghai real estate prices have soared by 8.7 times since 2001. They now stand to lose almost 80%. That's off the charts for real estate, but it's totally in line with the intensity and extremes of its real estate bubble, even while as many as 27% of the condos in major cities are vacant. This bubble originated at the same time as the one in Sydney in mid-2001. The 8.7 times gain gives this a high bubble intensity of 0.54. Based on these numbers and the fact that China has overbuilt its infrastructure and real estate capacity out by 10 to 15 years, I expect prices in Shanghai to take 16-odd years to hit bottom before they start to advance again. This long and deep decline, not only in Shanghai but all across China, will weigh heavily on Australia's real estate markets at first, and all of Asia, despite Australia's strong demographics in the decades ahead. My bubble model suggests that the Queen of the Orient could witness a crushing 78% loss, perhaps as much as 85% if prices go all the way back to the 2001 origin. The best case, though I don't see it as likely, would be a decline back to the late 2012 low, or a 47% decline. That's still major for a country where 75% of net worth is in real estate, as compared with 27% in the United States. Prices are up 1.88 times, or 88%, in just 3.5 years since 2012. That's crazy! But that's the key here. When things get as insane as they have in China, you know the bubble peak is close. When even Australian economists finally start to admit that they have a bubble, it's probably closer still. Finally, the U.S. real estate bubble took a little more than 6 years to deflate, from early 2006 into mid-2012, with the worst losses felt in 2008-09. We face a similar scenario ahead, a crash from late 2017 well into 2023, with the worst hitting in 2018 and 2019. Last time, the overall crash was 34% in the United States, but as much as 52% in Miami. This time, the model projects a 50% crash at best, and at worst, a 63% loss. Oh, this is going to hurt, with more homes underwater. In short, when this modern-day Mount Vesuvius blows, it'll decimate all the cities that have taken up root at its base, and it'll likely take 6 years or more into 2023 or so. Review your real estate holdings and consider what you really love and/or whether it's strategic to your life. Get rid of everything else now before the wheels come off this bus. Remember, real estate becomes agonizingly illiquid fast. I'm down to owning just one property on an island. Otherwise, I lease or rent. Use January 2000 as a most likely future valuation for your properties, and use 1996 as the worst-case scenario. Then decide if you love it that much. You'll likely be shocked when you look at your potential downside. With all this talk of bubbles bursting, let's turn our attention to the big question. What could set this disaster in motion? Chapter 13. The Six Bubble Busters. China's downturn will be like an elephant falling from an airplane. Harry Dent. As we've discussed, cycles are leading us into a time of revolution, chaos, and change. In the short term, that's a very bad thing. But in the long term, it's like a big cleansing that leads to the next spring season. Stock markets are more overvalued than they were at the end of 1999, when we saw the highest P/E ratios in U.S. history. Even Robert Shiller's superior cyclically adjusted CAPE shows this. But that begs the question, why? Why are stocks so high when there's nothing to support them? Economic and earnings growth are much lower in this recovery since 2012. Earnings growth has even been negative at times in recent years. Why are stocks still going up? Because they're in a bubble, and government-created interest rates, short and long-term, are the lowest in history, rewarding such speculation. Yes, interest rates are the lowest in history, mostly due to artificial stimulus and government bond buying. Debt levels are much higher, especially now at the government level, thanks to their idiotic, desperate, endless stimulus programs. And by the first quarter of 2017, we were nowhere near the ideal 3-4% growth. In fact, first quarter growth came in at a paltry 0.7% on an annualized basis. President Trump promised he'd get America back to sustainable 3-4% growth. It'll never happen, ever again, not during his presidency or in our lifetime. No matter how much fiscal stimulus and tax cutting is implemented, declining demographic trends and unprecedented debt will make it impossible. Japan is living proof that we can't beat the demographic wave downward. It has thrown more stimulus at the problem than any country in the world. Yet still, 20 years later, it has near zero growth, with zero productivity, and low inflation. In short, this situation is untenable. All we need is a trigger to start the avalanche. Lucky for us, we have six. Here they are. Bubble Buster 1. President Donald Trump. The man's a live wire, a walking time bomb. Although Republicans finally have a president with majorities in both houses of Congress, they're not a united party. Most didn't want Donald in the White House. Now that he's there, they're often fighting him right alongside the Democrats. He faces insurmountable resistance to his pro-business reforms, his immigration policies, his tax overhaul schemes, and his healthcare reform plans. His promise of 3-4% growth is unachievable and demographically impossible. Period. When the markets realize that, they'll crash. The truth is that Trump brilliantly won an election he wasn't favored to win, but he walked into the office at the worst time possible. And he's become a national security threat with his flapping lips, facing the threat of impeachment. Andy actually has a histogram that suggests Trump might be assassinated or forced to leave office in late 2017. The problem is that greater debt and deficits from fiscal stimulus and pro-business policies like tax cuts conflict with the constantly rising debt ceiling. The federal debt has doubled every two administrations, every 8 years, since George W. Bush's presidency in 2001. It went from $5 trillion to $10 trillion under Bush. It went from $10 trillion to $20 trillion under Obama. With the worst of our economic winter season ahead, any major tax cuts would push the debt from $20 trillion to $40 trillion. If Trump survives two terms, which I highly doubt. Any misstep Trump makes is a potential trigger. Then there's this. By late 2017, the strong job growth we've enjoyed since 2012 will very likely suddenly falter and disappear. Bubble Buster 2, Job Growth. We've been creating 200,000 or so jobs a month regularly since 2012. But what economists won't admit, or just don't understand, is that the workforce in the United States has barely expanded since 2007, and will decline in the next several years. This is a big deal, and a ceiling on future job growth, even if the economy doesn't crash, as we predict. In aging societies, and this is the case in almost all developed countries, baby boomers are draining out of the workforce, which eventually contracts it. And of course, this is predictable, as I explained in Chapter 6. The baby boomer spending wave peaked between 1983 and 2007, as they reached age 46. Their retirement wave started in 2000 and continues into 2026, assuming present average retirement trends with a retirement age of 63, though that will likely stretch out a bit as boomers realize they can't afford to retire in a bad economy. This has already occurred in Japan to a degree. And what happens when this outsized generation starts dying from 2017 into 2044? That'll kill the real estate market. Dyers are sellers, and population and workforce growth. But that's a story for another day. The simple truth is that, in this highly stimulated, zero-interest rate and QE-driven economy, we've merely been hiring back the workers we lost in the 2008-09 Great Recession. Painfully slowly as well, at just near 2% growth rates. By June 2017, we were approaching full employment again, with unemployment numbers coming in as low as 4.5%. At some point, there will be no jobs left to be had. That means either late-stage inflation, which is typical in most boom cycles, to bid retiring workers to come back in, or just no growth. Neither scenario is good for the economy. My point is that it's demographically impossible to sustain growth of 200,000 jobs a month, unless we increase the retirement age to 75. Try running on that platform as a politician. Although that will become a reality when the economy collapses and we all realize we're bankrupt, and that retirement for 22 years on the dole is impossible, as many labor unions are having to concede. This is why I think that job growth could suddenly slow down by the second half of 2017. I'm talking a drop to just 50,000 jobs a month or lower, not 200,000. That would be a cold slap of reality to the face of Wall Street. The figure 13.1 chart on the PDF shows the rebuilding of the workforce into 2017 back to 2008 levels. We are back at full employment, and the future looks rather flat. It also shows how natural workforce growth, 20-year-olds entering versus 63-year-olds retiring, will actually shrink into 2023 to 24. And then it grows at only 0.2% a year for decades after that. That's just 25,000 jobs a month. Bubble Buster 3, Greece and Italy. When Greece first defaulted in 2010 and threatened to leave the euro, the issue wasn't so much about the tiny country, but that other nations in southern Europe might follow. Well, Greece has debt payments due to the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and others, in July 2017. It cannot pay. This will raise the bigger issue of Italy. Italy has 18% non-performing or bad bank loans. 10% is typically bankrupt. Only Greece and Cyprus have a higher percentage of non-performing or bad bank loans, but neither of those countries is big enough to torpedo the euro. Italy has the greatest number of bad bank loans in the entire eurozone, 30% of the zone's total. This is a default waiting to happen. It's also a huge incentive for the boots of Europe to leave the euro and the eurozone. As Iceland did, and came out the better for it, Italy could leave the euro, devalue its currency to stimulate exports, and default on all foreign loans, from banks and governments. The price, as Iceland knows, would be high consumer inflation from greater import costs and the loss of access to future credit. But there's a bigger problem. Target 2 loans owed largely to the Central Bank of Germany. Europe's powerhouse, supposedly, has been floating the central banks of its major export partners in southern Europe, just to keep them buying. This is idiocy. It's essentially extending credit to less creditworthy customers so they don't lose the sale. Never mind that they'll likely be unable to pay. Germany is owed $747 billion, mostly from Italy and Spain. Italy's tab is nearly half of that, at $376 billion. If Italy leaves the euro and the eurozone, it could default on that debt immediately. Then there are the foreign bank loans to Italy. They total around $550 billion, $280 billion of which is from France alone, with $80 billion from Germany. Adding that up, Italy could default on more than $900 billion in foreign debts if it left the euro and the eurozone. That's the biggest incentive I've ever seen. And Italy is only second to Greece, with 47% of its population in polls saying they don't favor the euro, against only 43% favoring it. 53% of the Greek population isn't in favor of the euro. They may vote to exit the euro, even after all the bailouts they've gotten. But Italy could easily be next, and the loss of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi on his reform referendum was the first sign of a potential Italian exit. This is likely to be the most damaging bubble buster of them all. Meanwhile, there's another event that hasn't received as much notice as it should. Bubble Buster 4, the dissolution of the Union. Blue states start threatening to leave. Shortly after Trump became president, a petition was taken up in California to secede from the United States. The Yes California campaign needed just 576,000 signatures to put on the ballot in November 2018, a vote for California to declare that the United States is not the law of the land. Then it wanted to put on the ballot in 2019 a vote to actually leave the Union and become its own country. With almost 40 million people calling the state home and Trump's impulse control of a grease fire, that would have been easy. California leaving the United States would be like France leaving the eurozone. However, that petition has died out because the founder decided he wanted to live in Russia for the rest of his life. Maybe he was planted from Russia to disrupt the U.S. political system. Still, the threat and the issue behind the petition remains, as I explained in Chapter 4. Major countries and regions are breaking down into more religiously and culturally compatible units, in a backlash against globalization that is shaping up to be a megatrend for the next few decades. Trump's election started the red state, blue state civil war and has accelerated polarization between the two groups. The United States could break into a number of blue or red zones in the years to come, just as Europe could break into northern and southern zones, and China could break into an affluent urban coastal zone and a rural interior zone. Such events will shatter investor confidence and bring this aging bubble down in flames. It was the red states that were seceding in the Civil War, but since the Republicans are more in control, it makes more sense that blue states would consider leaving and possibly forming their own political and trading zones. That's the paradox. The more Trump and the Republicans succeed in passing their ultra-conservative and regressive agendas, the more the blue states could threaten to bolt. The obvious blue regions are the West Coast, the Northeast, and the Upper Midwest. Bubble Buster 5, seasonal trends, and potential turning points. Then there's Andy. He has his biggest turning points on his models for stocks in Europe and the United States popping up in mid to late October 2017. By our calculations, by late August, we could see an intermediate top, with something like a 10% correction into September. Then a final bubble surge into mid to late October. But we'll see when the turning points play out. That's the value of Andy's newsletter, markettimingreport.com. Then the past history of bubbles says there would be a high chance for a first dramatic and sharp crash that sees 30 to 50% down in just a few months. We see a topping process between late July and late December 2017 before a major crash begins. Seasonal trends, particularly in crash years, tend to hit in the July-November period, especially August to October. That's another reason that we could see a peak and a sharp crash at least begin in this time frame if this bubble is finally about to burst. Although July through November is typically the more likely time frame for a major crash, Andy's model suggests we're more likely to see it between late October and late January. Major long-term tops, like 1929 in the United States or 1989 in Japan, tend to come between September and December. Look at the figure 13.5 chart on the PDF. It highlights the major crash years, when markets saw exceptionally sharp crashes in very short periods. Notice how they tended to concentrate in this July-November timeframe. Bubbles burst suddenly and sharply. This one could be the worst, after being stretched longer and further than any past bubble. Note not only the typical 30 to 50% crashes in 2 to 3 months. Also note that, outside of the tech bubble burst, which included the biotech and internet sectors, most of those sharp crashes occurred in the July-November timeframe. And let's not forget China, the ultimate bubble buster. Bubble Buster 6, China. It wasn't enough the Soviet Union proved that centralized planning doesn't outperform bottom-up free market economies with democracy as a balance. It wasn't enough that all the dictatorships around the world, with their high corruption, proved the same, especially in the Middle East and Africa, and even Latin America. No, it was China that had to take this model all the way and try to prove that if you sneaked some capitalism in there but still kept government in absolute control, you could create a communist utopia. The smog choking the country is the first clue it's not working. The 16.4 times debt increase since 2000 is the next clue. The debt giveaway is the massive overbuilding of everything. Condos, infrastructure, office buildings, malls, railways, industrial capacity. How does a non-elected government keep its people happy? It creates endless jobs and wage growth through rapid urbanization and overbuilding everything, of course. Free markets can go nuts at times, but ultimately, a discipline toward efficiency always ensues. Not in China, where there are neither free markets nor democracy. The way to get rich in China is to become cozy with the local Communist Party boss who hands out all the building contracts and government-guaranteed loans. It's an oligarchy like Russia. It's just incorporated capitalism a little better and spent less on wasteful military expenditures than its neighbor to the north and west. I've said it over and over. China will be the final proof that top-down planning and bureaucracy doesn't beat bottom-up free-market capitalism and democracy, despite the obvious flaws of those two opposite systems. Their opposite characters are their very strength. Capitalism rewards individual contribution and merit. Democracy includes everyone in the system and aligns the troops with the generals. When people look at China today, they see the best and brightest starting up multi-million dollar companies. They don't see the everyday person living in the interior who survives on $2,000 a year and calls a shoebox condo home. The masses endure long commutes and suffer the effects of high pollution, traffic, and unaffordable real estate costs. That's why the massive force of rural migrant workers in more urban areas, where they're not registered citizens, recently peaked at 253 million. And that's why they've finally started moving back to their rural areas. Since 2014, 7 million Chinese have gone back home to the rice paddies. This should send chills down the spines of the top-down communist planners in China. It counters their core growth strategy of overbuilding infrastructure for nobody, assuming they will come in the future. Now they are really not coming. China's total workforce is the first in the entire emerging world to peak and decline since 2011. So how does the country grow at 8 to 12% with a declining workforce? It keeps moving more people into urban areas, a move that typically triples their income. And that has been China's top-down strategy. It keeps overbuilding everything to attract more rural migrants to work and or move into cities. It provides jobs for today and assumes that the stuff it's building for no one will eventually be needed by future rural migrants into cities. But this overbuilding has now reached epic proportions, with cities built for 1 million people standing largely empty. The largest mall in the world was turned into a tourist attraction because there were no retail clients. It was built in the middle of nowhere, for no one, so businesses didn't want to lease space. An estimated 27% of condos are empty in major cities. This from an independent survey that measures condos and houses finished and hooked up to electricity. No electrical use means they're empty. You can never listen to the official statistics from China, but in this case they're all we have. They're contrived and manipulated to keep confidence in the bubble going. Sound like central bank strategies everywhere else? By my estimates, China has now built enough overall infrastructure, housing, and industrial capacity for 10 to 12 years. The problem is, with migration trends reversing, there will be fewer people to occupy and make use of these increasingly empty structures. That's all fine and frightening. But what's the bubble buster event that could shake out the markets? An urban migration revolt. After 3 decades of massive rural to urban migration, the unregistered second-class citizens are voluntarily going back home. This is the death knell for the bubble of the top-down overbuilding strategy in China. As I've said for years, when the China bubble bursts, it'll be like an elephant falling from the sky. Anyone who says there will be a soft landing in China is 100% detached from reality. Anyone who thinks a top-down government can better plan growth than the free markets, which are much more accountable to reality, needs to go live in Russia. You and vodka will become best friends so you can drown your misery. Since mid-2015, China's stock market has foretold a broader crash and real estate bubble burst ahead. Its first dramatic bubble peaked in late 2007 and crashed 70% in 1 year. Yes, up 6.2 times in 2 years and then down 70% in 1 year. That is a bubble. Then there was the second bubble, stimulated by more government overbuilding and a 16 times increase in debt since 2000. It mutated again between mid-2014 and mid-2015. Then it crashed 43% in just 2.5 months. Why? The top-down government was trying to shift speculation back into stocks instead of real estate. Sound like a good strategy? Nope. There has been a dead cat bounce ever since, only it's been fueled by the government buying its own market to prop it up. That's like the $4.5 trillion QE that created a measly 2% growth in GDP in the United States, and less in Europe and Japan. Such a strategy won't succeed for much longer. Mark my words, there's another crash coming in China's stock market. One that will take it down 84% or so from its 2007 top, to hit the 1,000 level on the Shanghai Composite, and possibly lower. That will start a domino effect that will finally cause the Great China real estate bubble to burst more dramatically than that of any other country in the world, as the most affluent investors finally start to question real estate values, as they should. This will suddenly destroy wealth and send a tsunami of real estate crashes to crush all the English-speaking cities where the rich Chinese have laundered their money. And recall that the Chinese have 75% of their wealth in real estate, much more than in stocks, and far more than other major countries, where it's normally more like 27 to 40%. It's game over when the Great China Bubble crashes, and there's no amount of global QE and BS stimulus that will counter that megatrend. What to do? With all of that said, my advice to you is to get out of the markets now, both stock and real estate, if you're investing without a strategy, or if you're simply buying and holding as your stockbroker is telling you to do. With the speed at which the wheels could come off these buses, you'd be better off leaving the show a bit early, especially by mid to late October 2017, when Andy's and my cycles only turn down more aggressively. Remember, when stock market bubbles burst, they tend to lose close to 40% in just months. When real estate bubbles burst, your property becomes an anchor around your neck, as it becomes illiquid, unlike stocks or commodities. It also often has major debt attached to it. But don't abandon the markets altogether. There are incredible opportunities to make money during this crisis and after. Your best bet is to find a proven, time-tested strategy and stick with it. We have several to offer, any level and risk orientation of investor. You can find the details at dentresources.com. Buy and hold strategies have endured painful volatility since March 2000. They'll continue to suffer even more until at least late 2022. You need to choose safe asset strategies and proven trading systems that can excel in up and down markets, because we'll continue to see both ahead, but with more volatility and more downside than upside. You're going to hate most stockbrokers and financial advisors in the years ahead. In part 3, I'll detail several of the opportunities so you can start preparing now. Before we do that, though, let's get specific with some key markets. Then Andy has some more timing details for you.
Chapter 14. When you put it that way, when you see the cycles that are converging into late 2017, you'll realize that this book you're listening to is probably your saving grace. Andrew Pancioli. By the end of this chapter, not only will you know and understand why the period from late 2017 to early 2020 is likely to be one of the most critical in the world financial markets, you'll also know some of the key time windows when trend changes are highly likely to take place. First, here's an interesting factoid. The decennial cycle was first documented by Edgar Lawrence Smith in his 1939 book, Tides in the Affairs of Men. In what was really only a study of 40 to 50 years of stock market data, Smith found that years ending in 3, 7, and 0 were often down years. Years ending in 5, 8, and 9 were generally advancing years. His research was based on optimism and pessimism in human beings, and how weather, sunspots, and radiation affect their thought processes. Ned Davis came to a similar 10-year cycle conclusion with his study of stock markets over 100 years. It's just that we now have a better, more variable scientific cycle to predict than through sunspots. Well, the fact that 2017 ends in 7 means it could be one of the most bearish years in the decennial cycle, as was 1987. We're very susceptible to change this year, which I'll talk about more in a minute. First, though, know that the real secret to forecasting lies in super long-term cycles, and it's all about knowing where to look. I keep a series of crisis matrices that list all the significant economic occurrences that I can find. Then I analyze these events to unearth the critical cycles. Let's begin with the 72-year cycle, which starts with the 1929 Wall Street crash. As you know, the crash was preceded by the greatest boom of the first half of the 20th century. America could do no wrong. Neither could most of the Western world. Skyscrapers sprang up all around New York. Automobiles were in vogue in urban areas. And during the latter stages of the rampant boom, everyone was in on the stock market game. Even the shoeshine boy was recommending stock picks to his clients. Sound familiar to anything we're seeing today? That was the tip-off to Joseph Kennedy to sell his stocks. Subtracting 72 years from 1929, we arrive in 1857. That year saw one of the first modern-day financial crises to hit the globe, as I mentioned in Chapter 2. By then, the world was interconnected. This meant that the stage was set for a domino effect collapse to unfold. And it did. In America, the railroad boom was going bust for the first time. Railroad stocks peaked in July 1857, and then in August, the Ohio Life Insurance and Trust Company failed, triggering a financial panic. The United Kingdom was going through a currency crisis. The government of Prime Minister Lord Palmerston effectively violated the UK's banking laws by not keeping the appropriate gold and silver reserves, as had been decreed. And the nation had lost its edge in global domination due to the advancement of transportation, in particular steamships. She was not used to so much competition. These two superpowers sucked the rest of the world into the vortex. During the course of the next few years, the American stock market declined 62%. 72 years later, we experienced the Great Depression. 72 years after that was 2001. Most of the equity markets began peaking in 2000. And, of course, 2001 saw the infamous attack upon the Twin Towers on September 11th. The tech bubble had started in 1995. The stock market was on fire. Mobile phones, personal computers, the internet, you name it, were all the rage. Within 5 years, what began as a novelty had turned into a must-have. But by the end of the century, the steam had run out. Incidentally, the last 5 years of the previous two centuries, from 1795 to 1800, and from 1895 to 1900, saw major stock market booms. Doubling the 72-year sequence gives us 144 years. This is the period, as you have just seen, from 1857 to 2001. The 144-year cycle is as important as the 72-year one. Abhor 144. Take the inflationary crises of 1720, for example. That was the year that saw the South Sea and Mississippi bubbles burst. Adding 144 years brings us to 1864, a year that saw a massive thrust up in the commodity markets. Most of America was fighting the Civil War. There was no one tilling the land, and cotton was desperately needed for uniforms. Supplies of commodities were low, and demand was sky high. Such was the magnitude of the price surge that cotton, which had been trading at between 2 cents and 3 cents per pound, hit a price of $1.89 on August 23, 1864. That's a 60 to 90-fold increase in a matter of months. Add 144 years to 1864, and we're in 2008. Ring any bells? That was the year the commodity boom made its most recent long-term top on a 30-year cycle. Then there's the 100-year cycle, what Harry refers to as the centurial cycle. The power of 100. The year 1907 saw the rich man's panic. Economic uncertainty came in after the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. By 1907, credit had dried up. Otto and Augustus Heinzer had attempted to corner the copper market. They failed dramatically. By October, panic had set in. The market plunged 50% from the highs of the previous year and would head much lower still. Once again, there were runs on banks and many failures. Confidence in the financial system was severely shaken. Interestingly, J.P. Morgan himself was called in to help stabilize the markets with his vast wealth. Well, skip 100 years forward, and it was 2007, the year of the global financial crisis. A whole series of challenges, including the implosion of CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and CDSs, credit default swaps, led to a massive collapse. Interestingly, the government called on certain institutions to assist with the bailout. But this time, J.P. Morgan Chase, the too-big-to-fail bank, named partly for the old Wall Street titan, was on the wrong side. As you can see, history repeats pretty much exactly, and right on schedule. But let us take the sequence a little further and look at the midpoints of the 100-year cycle. Risky 50. Starting in 2007, if we go back 50 years, we find ourselves in 1957. That year, the market sold off over several months due to a general economic rundown caused partly by the saturation of the automobile market. By 1958, the world was in depression again, thanks to the policies of President Eisenhower and his government, which included raising interest rates. Go back another 50 years, and we end up in 1907. We've already talked about the rich man's panic, which was also known as the Knickerbocker crisis. Back another 50 years, and we see something really interesting. This takes us to 1857. We've already seen this in the 72-year cycle and the 100-year cycle. That's why it was such an important economic turning point. Something similar is happening in 2017. More on this shortly. 50 years before 1857 takes us to 1807, when the United States enacted the Embargo Act to supposedly disengage from European hostilities. American vessels were prevented from trading in any foreign port. This act stressed the U.S. economy immensely. Once again, you can see that this is another cycle that works like clockwork. There's one more cycle set that's critical to our future. It revolves around the 90-year cycle and its midpoint of 45 years. The 90-year cycle represents two 45-year innovation cycles that Harry documents. A perfect example of this is Brexit. Britain went to the polls on June 23rd, 2016. We all know the outcome of that referendum. I'd forewarned people that the UK leaving the Eurozone was a distinct possibility, because the most telling cycle was the recurrence of the 45-year cycle. This time it was to the day. On June 23rd, 1971, Geoffrey Rippon, the UK government's chief negotiator, reported to Parliament saying, "We have a very satisfactory deal." Up until this point, the French had been blocking Britain from joining the European Economic Community, as it was known then. Pro-marketeers cheered. Anti-marketeers groaned. The rest just lost the will to live. But what's interesting is that it was exactly 45 years to the day that Britain voted. Coincidence? No. You see, 45 years prior to 1971, on June 10th, 1926, Spain withdrew from the League of Nations, a similar kind of body to the EU in a broad sense, in protest of Germany being allowed to join. The recurring theme, European polarization. Doubling that 45-year cycle, we head back to the 1929 crash. Going back 90 years from that point takes us to 1839, which was, again, a year of crisis. Going forward from 1929, we reach 2019. We can expect a serious correction then, after most of Harry's cycles point to a first dramatic crisis from late 2017 into early 2020 or so. Adding 45 years to 1929 gives us 1974. The Western world had been brought to its knees by the Arab oil crisis and the dramatic 1973 to 1974 stock crash. This was a major turning point. The crisis itself began in October 1973, when OPEC launched an embargo against the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, Canada, and the Netherlands, in response to supportive American action for Israel during the Yom Kippur War. However, the recovery since then has extended to the present day. In fact, we can argue that 1974 saw the genesis of the present bull market. That gives us ominous signs for 2019. Before 2019, though, there's 2017 to contend with. What's about to happen? As we already know, years ending in seven are very susceptible to corrections, and my research shows that pretty much every year ending in seven in the 20th and 21st centuries had a major pullback. The fall of 2017 is exactly 10 years on from late 2007, and 30 years past late 1987 on the 30-year commodity cycle. From the high in 2007 to the eventual low in 2000.